Welcome back to the American Heritage Podcast. My guest today is Pete Turner. Pete Turner was in the Army both before and after 9/11, where he served as a spy. We talk about his experiences in Iraq as well as the time he spent in Egypt. He is also the host of a podcast called The Break It Down Show. You can check out his show by visiting www.breakitdownshow.com. All right, my guest today is Pete Turner. Pete, you are a man of many talents. You are a military veteran, a podcast host. You are a military influencer, and you are a personal mentor to me in the world of podcasting. I want to thank you for that.
Oh, thanks, man. That's kind of you to say it. And, you know, I've had a lot of help along the way, so I do what I can to try to help mentor and guide other folks. I'm lucky to be able to do this for a living, and I want to help as many people get over the pass. I call it the gorge, you know, and you kind of just make that leap and you see if you can do it. And so yeah. I'm honored to be able to help folks.
Yeah, well, it means a lot to me. You know, the podcasting is something I kind of just fell into and kind of fell in love with. And my niche is, as you know, is, you know, talking to veterans, and you yourself are a veteran. So what exactly, you know, what branch of the military were you in, and what was some of your experiences? I understand you were a pre and post 9/11 veteran. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I cover that gap. I was in the Army. I was a counterintelligence agent. And I did quite a bit in my very short time. And it turns out that I was better at being with the military than in it. So I was able to deploy to Bosnia when I was in the Army. And then actually responded on 9/11 when I lived in Chicago as I was in the reserves. And so I responded and went down to my, you know, our office, I guess you would call it, our armory, not really much of an armory, but I went immediately down and I stood by to stand by and then ultimately deployed to Egypt shortly after 9/11 in October of 01. I deployed for a short amount of time and did some counterintelligence work. And then, you know, ultimately separated in 2002, but came back as either a contractor, or sometimes the federal government holds their own contract and they're called term employees. So you're a federal employee, and it's mostly for legal reasons, to help deal with, can you carry weapons? Can you get medical care? So that's like the long and the short of it right there.
That's awesome. That's a pretty wide range of experience you have there. So what was it like being an Army counterintelligence guy? I mean, I know there's probably a lot you can't talk about, but can you break that down for us a little bit as far as, you know, what life was like in that role?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I can say most everything because all the stuff that I did was long enough ago, and I was a tactical guy. So the classifications for most of the things I did were fairly short term. You know, it ranges in my field. You could be someone who swept for bugs or did lie detector tests, or you could be in a strategic spot. Maybe you're supporting an embassy and wearing a suit to work every day and living overseas. In my case, I did what was called tactical counterintelligence or human collection. And my job was to go out every day and build a network of people that would tell me whatever it is that I needed to know for my commander.
That's pretty badass.
It is one of those jobs that it is badass, but sounds more badass than it is oftentimes.
Yeah, I kind of have a little bit of taste for that. I was an Air Force ISR guy for okay. several years. And it's one of those things you tell people, you know, and they think you're Jason Bourne, but if they were to walk a mile in my shoes, they'd be pretty damn bored most of the time, to be honest.
Yeah, well, and honestly, if you were to watch me working, you wouldn't realize that I was working. You would think that Pete just messes around and talks to people all day. But that's absolutely my job, is to go out and just have conversations and just slowly and gently weave those things into a fabric that delivers the truth in a way that, you know, I have uncommon access to the battlefield. My responsibility is to bring back the things that nobody else can. And that looks like I'm just goofing around most of the time.
Yeah. So I can only assume that since you were in Egypt, you were after Al-Qaeda affiliates. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't one of bin Laden's mentors from Egypt?
Yeah. I mean, it's fair to say that. And I think that is something that if it fell into my lap, that would have been something I dealt with. But, you know, honestly, what I did, my job was pretty simple, and the whole story in it is pretty impossible, because technically in the reserves, I was an 88 November. I was a manager of truck drivers, right? because that was my path into the reserves. I was getting transitioned over and did transition back into MI, but I deployed as a middle ranked guy, and the E6s above me were like, well, we're going to give Pete the crappiest job. I didn't even know we had jobs to pick from. You know, I just got a job picked for me. And I'm like, well, you guys don't need me here to do that, so I'm not staying. And I went over to the counterintelligence office and I said, license, credential, top secret clearance. I know this job as well as anybody you got. I know you need help. Do you need help? And the first response was, yeah, right, you're a counterintelligence agent. But I poked my head into their office and I knew one of the warrant officers, and he's like, Pete, you know, because the network is strong. So Chief put me to work and he's like, I got the best job. You have no responsibilities. I just want you to kind of oversee and mentor and just make sure everything looks right to you. And basically my job was truly a counterintelligence job. My job was to kind of be alert and see what was being collected on us or what kind of threat there was in the area, and sort of oversee his younger, greener agents while every day we went on tours of all the antiquity sites with MWR tours. So, and at the time, that seems like that's a cakey position, and it was wonderful, but my job ultimately was to liaise with the highest level Egyptians in the area to ensure that, you know, there wasn't going to be, you know, as much as possible, there wasn't going to be some kind of massacre. There wasn't some kind of exploitation event going on, you know, and you're sort of looking through a fog for something that you don't know what it is. So yes, cakey, it was super fun and we had a great time doing it, but still a serious work.
Yeah, that sounds pretty serious. I mean, that's kind of a big load to be carrying around on your shoulders, you know, trying to be responsible for preventing some kind of mass casualty event in a foreign country. Yeah, I can only imagine that probably carried a lot of stress with it too. So you were in Bosnia as well, and that's something that I'm not a whole lot familiar with. Can you kind of break down what was Bosnia all about for those?
Oh gosh, yeah, I'll give it a shot. So when we deployed, you know, we basically were, you know, pre-mobilization training in 1995 leading up to deployment in 96. And we really didn't know what we were going to get into at the time. The former Yugoslavian countries were just very lethal towards one another, you know, across country lines that didn't exist yet, across ethnic lines, there was genocide going on. So as far as we knew, you know, everybody said they were done fighting, but we didn't know. And clearly in the whole former Yugoslavia, they weren't done fighting. But in the case of Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, it seems like for the most part, once we got there, they were done. But we didn't know that at the time. At the time, there were millions and millions and millions of mines in the ground. Everybody was just waiting for the shoe to drop. And so it was quite tense when I was there with the first wave. And again, keep in mind, I'm out. I'm forward deployed. There's four of us, maybe five people running around trying to meet people, and we're wearing uniforms, you know, so you're sort of, you're always waiting for something to happen while you're trying to prevent something from happening. And that was my job, is to go out every day and talk to people and try to figure out what was or wasn't happening. And over the course of time, everything kind of mellowed out because we realized in that area where we were, everybody was pretty happy. We bounced around, but that was the ultimate feel, was everybody was at least taking a long-term pause from fighting. And it seemed like the peace accord worked, at least in terms of where we were. So breaking it down, it was a very complex and unknown time where we had been briefed on and prepared for combat. But ultimately, we were fortunate in that everybody was basically done with that.
Well, that's good. I mean, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, obviously, things like that can be absolutely crazy, and you never know what you're going to get yourself into. And I'm glad that, you know, it ended up being kind of a success story from the best I can tell, you know, as far as that military operations go.
I think you could call it a success. I mean, it's a part of Europe that's now, for the most part, stable. Heck, the person who produces my podcast, he's Macedonian. It's the same area. He's, you know, within 100 miles of where I was. So it's you know, I now employ a person from from the Balkans to help me produce my show. So yeah, I think it worked pretty well. It's not perfect, but yeah, I'm happy.
Yeah, I mean, nothing is perfect. I mean, you know, I spent time in Iraq, you know, and I look at Iraq now, you know, when I got out, then the rise of ISIS and things like that, you know, and I kind of just shake my head sometimes. And, you know, I kind of wonder, you know, what the future is going to hold for all that. And, you know, what are all of our expenditures in life and capital, you know, what they're going to amount to in another 20 years.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, I really saw a lot of potential as I was wrapping up my Iraq phase that they really, you know, it was ugly, didn't make a lot of sense, but it seemed to be sort of working. And, you know, we just, as a nation and our plan, we just weren't prepared to see through what needed to be seen through. And I was hopefully optimistic, but truthfully, I was balanced on a whole lot of skepticism, you know, because when I would go around, again, my job is to go into town. So I'm talking to everybody and all of the Iraqis are saying, the second you guys leave, we're going to go fight. You know, people are going to come attack us. Nobody had faith in their own system. And I don't know that we could have changed that, but I know by leaving it, we ensured that their self-fulfilling prophecy happened.
Yeah, I agree, you know, and I've read a book and heard about a book. It's called Fiasco. And basically the general idea behind that is that disrupting the army was probably the most terrible idea we had because they literally controlled everything, the power, the water, the civil peace, when really we should have tried to in some capacity maybe leave the army intact while taking out the leadership. I mean, hindsight's 2020 and we can never go back, but yeah, we kind of created a serious power vacuum in which the, you know, sectarian strife kind of flowed into, it seems like.
You know, I don't think that that's a wrong answer, but I don't agree with it. I think that that is an obvious answer. But again, I talked to thousands of Iraqis. That was my job every day. And one of the things they said was, this is not sectarian, it's political. You know, so yes, the Sunnis and Shias were a dividing line, but it wasn't because of religious beliefs. No one cared about that. It was not sectarian. And the other thing was, we weren't prepared. We weren't prepared to fight the fight that was there on the ground. And even to this day, when my peers talk about this and I write about it, so I write a lot of academic based articles, you know, what I would say is the population was the center of gravity. And it drives my combat peers crazy because they say, I don't understand center of gravity, but I'm going to tell you right now, people didn't believe in the system that we were trying to bring to them. And so if they, I would ask people routinely about, you know, their level of tolerance to call and trust the police, and I couldn't find it. This is 10 years in. So, you know, so if they weren't going to call their own police force, if they didn't know anybody on the police force, if we had a thing, I'll tell you a story. We had a thing where I was in the Baghdad province, and just south of us, if my memory serves, it was Diyala province. And so there was a U.S.-backed special forces, Iraqi special forces unit that would come across the river and snatch people out of our province, bad guys, quote unquote, bad guys. And so we happened to be at the police station one day talking, and I'm like, so what's something that's happening that's out of your control that I should know about? And he's like, I got legitimate Iraqi dads who aren't causing a problem sleeping in ditches outside of their homes because they're afraid they're going to get snatched up. Nobody understands what's happening. People are getting arrested. And I know that in your country, you have to issue a warrant. We don't even see these warrants. And so I write this report up and I'm like, oh man, this is a real problem. Because now this police chief, instead of doing policing, he's managing a forest fire, you know, and he can't do anything by himself. And so I write the report up literally, and I'm not kidding, Seth, the next night they came and they snatched somebody and they took the warrant and they stabbed it on the dining room table with a knife. So they served, and they're like, that's not how it works. Whether that guy who got arrested or not was bad, it's really irrelevant. What you did was you didn't serve a warrant properly. And when you did do it, you did it out of spite. And now the cop in the local area has no chance to fix that. And so we're dividing the population further from the government. And we weren't trained to deal with these things. We focused on threat all the time. We weren't able, like people talk about hearts and minds. Here's the problem with that. Yes, hearts and minds are valuable. The center mass, the civil population is the, you know, center of gravity. But it's not us that need the hearts and minds. It's the Iraqi government. It's the Iraqi police, the Iraqi army. They had to believe in their own government, and we couldn't, and we weren't trained to do that. So the military thing, yeah, maybe the Iraqi army mattered. But the thing is that we tried to bring in a whole new system, but we sucked at implementing that system and getting people to believe in it.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, I saw a couple things with my own two eyes about people not trusting their own government in Iraq and, you know, bad follow through. I mean, at the very last minute, there would be times where the mission would be changed. Instead of sending out U.S. forces, they would send out Iraqi forces. And, you know, we would do our thing and kind of check up on them in the process. And so rather than kicking down the door and rolling up this guy like we had planned to do, they pulled up and politely knocked on the door and had a conversation with this guy face to face that we're observing. And then they turn around and leave and go home. You know, in the U.S. forces, I mean, obviously they had the target package and they needed to roll this guy up because they considered him to be a high value target. But the Iraqis just didn't consider it that way. And I think it's exactly what you said. I think that in their minds, once we leave, they're going to have to live with this guy in some capacity. So we might as well try to make that as easy as possible now so we don't have to fight this guy later.
There are so many problems with all of that right there. I mean, that is exactly us. Like, okay, great, the Iraqi army's in place. How do we still deal with this part of it? You know, we would – look, I've done targeting. I've put lethal target packages together and said, you know, as far as I can tell, this guy's a bad guy. I don't know. I've also been on the other end of it when the door gets kicked in and it's the wrong guy. I've seen this so many times where our desperation, I won't say that's not fair, our need to stack up lethal packages and put people in jail outweighs our need to establish a balanced government that the people believe in. So we would rather make a mistake on killing somebody than getting 15 people to come and consume their own government. And I can give you 100 examples of that. But that is the problem, is our lethal focus was wholly inappropriate. But again, this is not the problem of any one service member. It's just the institution. We are a big lethal machine. And so when we go out and try to do nation building for all intents and purposes, it's very hard to go do that. And nobody's equipped to do that mission. And now we're asking the military to not train for it and execute it on the fly. It doesn't work. And I'll give you an example of that. So we're working with the mayor, who was ultimately assassinated, but not when we were there. And he said, hey, you guys, and I was studying greenhouses at the time, trying to figure out their impact on the area. And he's like, hey, these greenhouses, he brought them up. Can you guys stop giving them out or give them to me to give out? Because I spend an inordinate amount of my day dealing with these things, salving people's offense, making, you know, the wrong people get them, the right people. I deal with these things. All you guys are doing is taking up all of my time, and the wrong people are getting these things. If you're going to give them out, please, let's at least work together. But I would prefer you just give them to me and let me handle it. So this guy couldn't even govern, not because of the Iraqi people, but because we created so much instability with our system that he was begging us to stop.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I mean, it must be maddening to try to constantly work around all that. It's a never-ending problem. Do you think that given a long enough time frame that it could have happened?
That's a hard question. We were never prepared to execute the mission that was required on the ground, and we refused to learn it. You know, all of our lessons learned centers focused on wrong things. Unit after unit came in having to relearn the same lesson. And so basically we were such a destabilizing force. I don't think that generation of the military was equipped to handle the mission from an institutional, mental, any of those states. So and there were just too many. It was hard to see at the time, but there were too many inhibitors in our own way, where our needs superseded everything else and our needs weren't in alignment with the strategic goals. Our ground truth, our tactics, and our strategic goals, none of those things were congruent or working to support one another.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of my same opinion too. I mean, I don't think that enough time is possible. You know, I think we would have just had a lot more of the same, and never would have worked, kind of like how we wished it would have worked, which is unfortunate, because, you know, that was, you know, that was a long war and we spent a lot of time and there were a lot of lives lost there. And you want to have an overwhelming sense of victory and success. And, you know, unfortunately, we just don't have it. And, you know, that kind of sucks.
Let me jump in and just add some color to what I'm talking about here, because, you know, I've had a lot of different high-end operators on the show, and I work in that field because I'm out in front with those guys. And to a man, every single special operator I've talked to, I've asked this question. I've said, in combat zones, have you fired more bullets or had more conversations? Every single one of those SEALs, special operations, Delta Force guys, they've all said, it's not even close. It's way more conversations than bullets. And then the follow-up question is, where did you put most of your training? Absolutely on lethal activity. So here's your evidence right there. The tip of the spear, the people that you expect to be the most lethal are saying the same thing. We had way more conversations. And you know what we don't have? We don't have an advanced interpreter operations badge or school. We just go and we make up interpreter operations. We call them terps. We look down on them. We don't trust them. And so we're going to talk more than anything else, and we can't even use an interpreter at an advanced level.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, we have that school, I think, in Monterey, that's the Defense Language Institute, and it's a pretty high school. But I don't think it probably serves the need it really needs to serve. That would be more of a rear echelon kind of a sit down and take all day to decipher a message kind of a thing rather than a combat scenario type of a thing.
Yeah, and language capacity is a big thing. I'm not a big proponent of it because it's hard to develop the mastery that you need. I mean, you can go learn Arabic. You're going to learn modern standard Arabic, but then you're going to go to Iraq and they don't speak that there. They speak a different form. So they'll understand you, and you're trying to figure out how to understand them. You need an interpreter anyhow. So we can give everybody the ability to work with an interpreter at least a basic level. And the folks like me who are going to go out every day, we can give them a reliable means of working with an interpreter. We can teach them, like people always say, establish rapport. Okay, well, how do you do that? What does that mean? How do I know when I have it? I mean, you can tell me how to put a round on a target of 300 meters reliably, but you can't tell me how to establish rapport. But I'm going to establish rapport more than I'm ever going to shoot my weapon at 300 meters. Come on. So, like, yes, language proficiency, of course, is a bonus, but let's not make it so hard on ourselves. Let's just learn how to work an interpreter at the basic level and then the advanced level.
Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense to me, and I'm in agreement with that. So my understanding is that you had the opportunity to meet a interpreter and work with an interpreter and have built a pretty good relationship with him since then. You know, that's a pretty interesting story. Would you mind kind of sharing a little bit of that?
Gosh, I've had so many interpreters, and I'm in contact with a good number of them still to this day. I guess most notably would be Johnny Walker, who I think I've connected you with him. Johnny Walker was an Iraqi. He's an American citizen now, but he went on more SEAL missions in Iraq than any SEAL. And when he came back to the States, because they had to get him out of there because he was going to die there. When they brought him back, they made him one of their own, and he can wear the trident among all the SEALs, and he's never been to BUDS. So he's an incredible dude, and he was my interpreter, and I guarantee if you talk to him, he's never had anybody work with him how I did, because I was able to build a system that worked, and I've got any number of interpreters that can tell you the same thing. And it starts with trust and respect. You know, I gave them parameters to work within. They understood what I needed from them, and I let them help me at a level that, like, they weren't just a mouthpiece for me. They were half me, half my partner. And they understood, like, I could shut up for long periods of time because they knew the conversation I wanted to have. And then they would have it and back brief me as I did it. Or sometimes I would have another interpreter stand there and talk to me in my ear, you know, so I could understand what was going on while I trained them really to do my job because they can do it better and faster than I could.
So it's awesome that, you know, he was able to earn that trident and become an American citizen. But my understanding is that's not necessarily the norm for those guys, right? So the ones that have helped us out in Iraq and Afghanistan, they don't always get the treatment of coming over and becoming American citizens. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's almost embarrassing. I mean, as much as we want to talk about the border crisis and everything else, we have people that legitimately have given up their lives to serve with us and put their families and themselves at great risk. And then we just peace out on them. And frankly, if you want to talk about disgusted, you can start right there. I mean, it really aggravates me that there are so many people. And I've got an interpreter right now who's basically stuck in Iraq forever. You know, he just doesn't seem like he'll ever get to come home. And he would love to be here. He would be a great American. And he's likely to die in Iraq at some point in some violent way because he just can't get out of there. He doesn't know the right people and he can't pull the trigger and there's not enough money. And here, this guy worked his heart out for me. He did extremely dangerous things day after day, exposed himself to threat. And I just don't understand why we're so stubborn with bringing these great people home.
Yeah, that's terrible to hear. I mean, it's got to be heartbreaking. I mean, having friends basically stuck in a perpetual war zone for all eternity. I mean, that just blows my mind. There needs to be some kind of a bill passed in Congress,
yeah,
something to get these guys home.
No, I agree. It's a shame. And, you know, we got to do what we can do for them. And I always try to support their cause either through my own words or actions. But yeah, it's something that we've got to get better at, because these are folks, if we're going to take a risk on somebody, I want these guys to be in the front of the line. Even if we turn around, send them right back in the military, you know, and that's their foundation for getting their citizenship. I would be a lot more permissive. I would rather grab two bad apples and 100 of the great people and then have a chance at converting those bad apples into great people as well than to miss out on any of the great people that are desperate to be Americans.
Yeah, you know, and I saw that petition that you had on your Facebook group, actually. So, and I signed that today.
Thank you.
Change.org, I believe. There's a petition you can go on and sign, and it's petitioning the White House and the government to bring these guys over to America. You know, and they've already been vetted. You know, hundreds and hundreds of Americans know them and can attest to their character. So, yeah. You know, if you care at all about that, you know, if you're moved by that story, I would encourage anybody listening to go to change.org and look up that petition and sign it. So that kind of brings me to, I guess, my next question. You know, so you did some contracting work in Iraq, and then when you got out and kind of quit that lifestyle, so what were you up to? You know, what was your first gig, you know, post-military and government service?
Boy, that is a tough question. So I didn't have one. You know, I did a little bit of work here and there. I did, and keep in mind, I had done a lot of time. I've got over 1,000 combat missions. I didn't want to live and work in the threat world anymore. I wanted to do something else. And so I didn't want to go work for a contractor in Washington, D.C., because that was where the work was. I wanted to get out of that and do something that was, you know, not focused on who's going to get who and everything else. I was sick of it. And so I came back to California and literally could never find a job. I applied and I applied and I applied and I actually used the number 1,000 because I went on 1,000 combat missions. So I'm like, I'm going to apply to 1,000 jobs. And I got 2 interviews out of all of that. And just to fill in the blanks, I had professionals write my resume. I'm an excellent interviewer. I didn't even get calls back to get interviewed, right? The 2 interviews that I did get were favors from friends. And one guy said, I can't afford you, before he ever asked me what my price might be. And the other guy said, you should go back to Afghanistan.
Huh.
So there was no transition for me. I had to make money. All of my life was falling down around me because, you know, I had no relationship anymore. My money was dwindling and ultimately ran out. You know, professionally, I went from being highly relevant and really mattering to being irrelevant, ignored.
Yeah,
unusable. And what's worse than folks from like us who go and serve the country? What's worse than being useless?
So, not much.
Yeah, I became useless. And so I started doing handyman work. And I'm not handy at all, but I figured it out, you know, and I was really good at customer service. And so I built a pretty successful, you know, handyman business, but never was the intention to do that full time. It's too hard on my body. And it wasn't really what I wanted to do. I was more drowning than surviving. And so that was what I did when I first came back.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I hear that a lot and I, you know, have a very similar experience. I think the shock of getting out of the military once and for all and just kind of finding your purpose, it takes a while. And I think you got to do a little bit of suffering too in order to kind of earn it, I guess, is kind of how I view that. You kind of have to do some things you don't want to do to kind of get an idea of what sucks, to kind of give you an idea of what you do want to do. So ultimately, you know, you started your own business and became successful. And then you you also started a podcast. And you said you're a full-time podcaster now. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm a professional podcast producer. Yeah, I create content for you know, people, brands, companies. And I'm also starting to create scripted dramas for companies that buy that sort of thing.
Oh, that's awesome. So the name of your podcast is called the Break It Down Podcast, right?
Yeah, the Break It Down Show. Yeah, it's awesome. Break It Down Show.
Yeah, so you have a lot of awesome guests on there. I see you have a lot of really cool guys, like Navy SEAL types and Johnny Walker and a lot of other really awesome guests.
Yeah, I mean, it's a veteran-produced show for sure, and we have a lot of veterans on the show because I always try to support what we do. But it's not a veteran podcast. It's about life, you know. So we have authors, we have actors, we have musicians. Our musicians, just to give you an idea, our musical artists have sold over 1.5 billion records.
Wow.
They've won several dozen Grammys. These are elite performers who have nothing to do with the military. So when you listen to my show, I guess you could say it's sort of Rogan-esque. You don't know who's going to walk in the door, but they're going to blow your mind. And that's my job, is to use my spy skills to find greater and greater people all the time. And then when they're sitting in that chair, open them up in a way that nobody else has done with them before.
Yeah, that's cool. And, you know, I think there's a different niche for that, because in society, it's so clickbait and everything's so superficial. I think people are hungry for that, you know, and for you give an opportunity for people to hear those kind of conversations they don't get on a normal basis. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I'm not focused on the salacious. I'm focused on reasonable conversation. So I'll tackle something, especially if it makes me uncomfortable, you know, like the border issue. I don't know what to think. You know, the tactical side of me knows what to do, but the strategic side of me doesn't agree with that side. So I like to go into places where I'm uncomfortable and find experts to really, and not try to, you know, destroy somebody, but try to listen to them practically, even if I disagree, and see where the reason is. And then, you know, work on those things, because we're all a lot more alike than we're not. And if we don't focus on some of that, then, you know, we choose to divide ourselves. And you know, Abe Lincoln said it a long time ago, you know, house divided can't stand. So I definitely focusing on the middle, making the middle sexy. And not every topic is political either. Sometimes we talk about, you know, fitness and health and salvation and recovery. It just kind of depends on the day.
Yeah, that's awesome. That, you know, I can't get enough of that kind of stuff. I'm a big fan of Rogan for the exact reasons you mentioned. You know, he has a way of getting people on a show in a one-on-one, especially people who are normally provocative, right? He can get them on a one-on-one setting and have a 3-hour conversation, and you walk away with a deeper appreciation of each of the people that is on a show. You learn something about them, and you kind of get to see their point of view. When normally it would be simply just a tweet or something. You get a little more inner workings on how their brain works on some of those issues.
Yeah, and you have a chance to ask the obvious question that's hard for them. You know, I'm thinking about Joe Rogan had Bernie Sanders on, so I was interested. So I listened to what Bernie had to say. I'm not opposed to Bernie Sanders. I think he wants good things for America, but so does Dan Crenshaw. And those two guys don't see the world in the same way.
Right.
So we all exist in the same world, and these two things aren't the same. So what are we supposed to do? How do we find something we can all agree on to work on? Is it gun violence? Okay, great. Let's have that conversation. But these things don't tolerate simple solutions. And this goes back to my time in combat zones. I've seen what happens when we come in with an answer and it doesn't work. You know, these are complex, slow moving problems, and they just don't tolerate simple things like banning guns, for example. I'm not taking a position, I'm just illustrating, you know, just one simple thing, medical care for all. Well, that's great. That's a great goal. But reality is it's much more complex. There's billions of dollars of industry tied into this current structure. So you would have to literally get everybody to give up everything and get in a line where everybody has sacrificed something to get something that's maybe better. And that line of people doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah, there's too many people, you know, who have their livings and their livelihoods wrapped up into that. And to, you know, think about giving away that kind of stuff for free, it's scary to them, and they're going to resist it as long as possible. It makes total sense to me. So next question I have for you is, you know, you have a little bit of experience, you know, transitioning out of the military, and now you're, you know, a podcast host. Do you have any advice for people who are leaving the military right now? What would you tell somebody who is listening to this?
Pretty simple. whatever it is that you think you want to do, be prepared for changes. I think we all know that, you know, that the trail, when you look back, is going to be crazy and way harder than you ever thought. So feel free to underestimate how hard it is, but be prepared to change and tackle things that you can't foresee. And if you're not seeing those things, then either you're lucky or you're missing everything. So get a mentor. Find someone in your industry, and there's never been a better time to do this. Look around, get a hold of someone, and just say, hey, I'm trying to get into this industry. I'm looking for a mentor. Would you do this for me? Or could you recommend someone so that I have a better understanding of what I'm getting into? Because here's the reality. And I'm talking to a guy in the military who's transitioned out, and he's having a rough time. And he's just obstinate. I'm like, look, you need help. You need someone who can help you, guide you on this path. He's like, the more you say that, the more I want to do it myself. And I'm like, hey, that's great. You be obstinate and don't have anybody help you. But the people around you that get help, legitimate help from other people, they're going to outperform you. You can't just, nobody wants someone who's obstinate around. Nobody wants someone who's stubborn. You want to learn how the people in the world that you want to work in, how they act, how they behave, so you can start to join them culturally. If you refuse to do that, then you're going to have a problem. Like, we all take it, all of us struggle with, like, where's my hat when you first get out? I got to have my hat at all times and account for my hat. Where's my hat? You know, we all want to stand up at attention when we hear the Star Spangled Banner. Those things fade in time. So what I'm saying is professionally, look for someone who's 10 years, 5 years, 20 years down the road from you, whether they're military or not, just people that are desperate to help out veterans. And they're not veterans. They're just people that are absolutely in love with people who serve this country, and they want to do anything they can to help. Don't deny those people that. You know, these are industry leaders that would absolutely bend over backwards to do everything they can to put you in a position to earn it. That's the first thing and the main thing I would say.
Yeah, that's awesome advice, you know, and that's something that I wish I would have heard 2 years ago, you know, because, you know, I didn't have a mentor when I got out. I didn't go to any of the transition stuff. I thought I had a pretty kick-ass plan, and, you know, I was going to step right into corporate America and go right up the ladder from there. And that's not exactly what happened. But, you know, I learned things the hard way. So, you know, I learned my lesson and, you know, moved on. And here I am. But, yeah, that's awesome advice. I appreciate you giving that.
Yeah, yeah. I have a friend who's really simple with all these kind of things. He's like, you can do it that way. What? Why would you? You know, it's like, well, yeah, I guess you're right. Like, there are people that want to help me. You know, get your here. So here's a lesson. If you haven't figured this out, ego, for the most part, is bad. Yep. And if your ego isn't under control, and if you think you're going to out something, great. Get your ego in control. That's your first step. That's where your work is. Because this is not about you. This is not about your pride. It's this, whatever it is you're going to choose to do is going to be hard. You know, life is going to give you obstacles. Heck, this morning, 5-something in the morning, our dogs got skunked. Our entire day got changed by that, you know? And that's not any harder than anybody else's day, but, you know, life doesn't ease up. It just does those things. And so you're trying to break into a new industry. You're trying to, you know, transition out. Yeah, it's going to be hard. Get somebody who can go, hey, this right here, this is going to be hard. Expect it. And this is where you should put all your work. Don't put your work in pushing down a wall that doesn't have to be pushed down. It's a door 5 feet to the left. I'm a mentor. Let me show you where the door is. Look at this door. Go through this door. You may have to pick that lock, but that's where your work is. Quit trying to knock this wall down. You're going to piss everybody off.
Yeah, that's very wise. Thank you.
Yeah, no, my pleasure.
So if anybody wanted to find out about your podcast and, you know, your website and stuff like that, where can people find your material?
It's pretty simple. I'm all over the, I'm all over social media. I'm pretty active. You can find me on Minds, Parler, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of it. Pete A. Turner. And then the show is called The Break It Down Show. That's my main thing. I also produce podcasts. So I want to make sure I talk about Where Traveler podcast. If you're into travel, I produce the Strata Combat Radio Show. There's several others, but just hit me up on whatever social media thing. Look, I'm glad to help. I've had so much help. I can't even tell you. So I have a big debt to everybody who's mentored and guided and pulled my butt out of the fire. So don't be afraid to reach out. And if you're into podcasts, great. Check out my show, breakitdownshow.com. You can find me on YouTube, iTunes. It's everywhere. Just know that, like, I'm the kind of guy that's going to keep telling stories. And if you like stories, then I think you might like my show. Give it a shot.
Yeah, well, thanks for putting that information out there. I'm sure a lot of people will love to check out your show and hear some of those stories, you know, because that's kind of what we do here. So I'm sure it's a very similar audience.
Yeah, it's one of the best things. It's the best thing in my life that I've ever done, you know, save my daughter being alive, healthy, well, and smart and everything. But the ability to tell these stories, to have these personal interactions and share them with the world, it can, the more value I put into my show, the more time and effort and goodness I put into it, in a variety of ways, the more it just continues to be a bountiful blessing of wonderful things. I can't even tell you. It shocks me to say this, but it remains true. Every month, I think we're at 90 countries now. Every month, 90 different countries participate in the show in some way. They listen to it. I've got a huge audience in France. Who knew? Huh. I didn't try to do that. It just happened. My audience in the Balkans is exploding right now. You know, I get to talk to incredible people. Stuart Copeland from The Police sat across the couch from me. Huh. You know, and we, and I don't want to say we're friends because that wouldn't be accurate, but we exchange emails, I don't know, once, twice a year, just about something. And I have so many of these wonderful things where I'm able to help people, connect people, hear these incredible stories, find different ways to get over obstacles. It's just, I can't tell you how incredibly fortunate I am to be able to do this.
That's awesome. That's really inspirational to hear.
Yeah, I love it. And same thing with you, man. Keep going. Like, you're on your way. Just keep going, because you're absolutely doing it. And I'm sure you already know this because you've been at it for a while, but it's incredible to do what you're doing and to be able to, you know, create some kind of a marketplace of love and connection and positivity. It's just so wonderful.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. You know, it's kind of therapeutic for me in that way, because I get to meet so many people and have some pretty awesome conversations. But I like to think that the people who are listening get a lot out of it too. So that's why I always try to ask people like you, you know, the advice questions, because if I'm curious about it, there's probably a lot of other people who are just as stubborn as I was. Sure. Who might not ask it, but maybe they can absorb it through other means. So
yeah.
So, I try to be a focal
point. Be open to receiving help. You know, I'll tell you a thing. It was my pride that got in the way. You know, my hometown, they're very supportive of me. They don't necessarily listen to the show. And a lot of people do. But, you know, you want like more people. And I'm like, you're my people. But the reality is when I go home, I can't buy lunch. I can't buy a drink. Everybody's like, I'm going to support you. Here's a burrito. You know, they give me love and all these different things. And I'm like, this all has value. Like, my friend's like, I don't have time to listen, but I am, every time I see you, I am going to buy you lunch, you know, to make sure that you don't got to pull 20 bucks out of your pocket because I believe in what you're doing. Man, that's incredible support. But I had to get over myself first to take it and go, yeah, man, that's cool. Let's do it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Those are good friends.
Absolutely. They love me. And I love those guys, and I love creating it. I used to be upset about it. Right now I realize how valuable it is and how they contribute in the way that's best for them.
Yeah, that's awesome. If I ever make it out that way, I'll buy you lunch.
All right. And I'll buy you a beer. We'll go to my favorite place, the Tustin Inn.
Hey, I like beer.
I like beer.
All right. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, man. Listen, seriously, I appreciate it. Let's have you on my show and let's talk about some of your charitable work. That's exciting to me. I should mention my charitable charter just because it's important. There's two things that I do. I support folks who have ALS and try to get them all the help I can because my buddy Phil is battling that disease. And also I'm affiliated with Save the Brave. Save the Brave is a charity that works on getting veterans who are, you know, suffering from PTSD, gets them out, gets them with other veterans, gets them on the water, and they do some deep sea fishing. And it's just such an incredible thing to watch these guys who are struggling have big, gigantic smiles on their face and just have one more good thing happen for them and just continue to connect in. And as we all try to figure out how to deal with this 22 a day, getting out there and being in the space, you get to see the smiles, the redemption stories, and you get some hope for those that are out there. You can say, look, I can put you in front of 25 people right now that were suicidal and now they're not. So we can all do this if we work together. And so support Save the Brave when possible.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm going to look that up. Maybe I can have them on the show too and talk about their mission.
I'll connect you with Scott Husing. I'm sure he'd love to do it.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks for the tip.
No worries. Thanks again for having me on. Anytime I can be on someone's air, I'm really grateful for it. Thank you so much. Yep.
Thanks again. It's been great. See you soon.
Thanks for listening to the show. Be sure to check out the new website at www.AmericanHeritagePodcast.com. There you can find blog articles that I write, and also there's a tab for merchandise. There you can find new shirts that I have. I have one on right now. It's called the Max Effort, and it features an F-105 Thunder Chief dodging an SA-2 North Vietnamese anti-aircraft missile over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This shirt was inspired by a conversation I had with Wild Bill in one of the earlier episodes. Be sure to check out that episode and head to the website to pick up your shirt today. Thanks for listening to the American Heritage Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends. Also, if you wouldn't mind, please consider being a donor. You can click on the support tab at the bottom of the show notes of this episode and every other episode. If you do that, you'll help offset some of the costs that come along with podcasting. Also, I will give a percentage of the proceeds straight back to homeless veterans via the Passageways LTD organization. They help homeless veterans get off the streets once and for all. So consider being a donor today. Once again, thanks for listening.